Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett. Here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, episode 14. Today we have Aaron Houston on, the CEO of Wearwell. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thank you so much, Eric. How's it going?
It's going pretty good. Just watched the eclipse. How are you doing?
Good, good. Just did the same from a rooftop. It was pretty exciting and glad to be talking to you.
Right on. Cool. So we'll get right into it. You know, I wanted to bring you on the show as someone who, you know, runs a company. I've been wanting to get more corporate leaders on. And I think your story is pretty interesting. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and a little bit about Wearwell, and then we can kind of go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with Wearwell, just since that is what I focus on day and night these days. So to kick us off, Wearwell is a conscious fashion company. We are focused on making it easy for women to find clothes that fit their style and their values. And we do that through a subscription service where they can fill out a profile with us, tell us about their style, tell us what they care about. We curate items, send those items to her. She keeps what she loves, and she sends back what she doesn't want. And we're connecting her with not just fashionable pieces, but the impact behind each style, with pretty lofty goals in the long run of working for large-scale change in the global fashion industry, when that comes to sustainability and ethics and workers' rights. A little bit about me. I know, Eric, we met in a coffee shop, a wonderful meeting, when I was in New York. And I travel a lot between New York. I hail from Philadelphia. I travel between D.C. and New York all the time because I have a former career background in international development. Worked in media and communications, worked with a bunch of Fortune 500 companies that kind of allowed me to see a space open up in the market for conscious fashion. And here I am today.
Interesting. So what had you want to get into fashion?
So a lot of people, whenever they hear me introduce myself, they assume that maybe I had been working in fashion for a while or I always had an affinity for it. And that's actually not correct at all. My background is quite different than that. I've always, since I was a little girl, had an interest in aesthetics and design, and actually at one point wanted to be an interior designer when I was a kid. But really why I got into this space was because of my deep and lifelong interest in global women's issues. So if you rewind to when I was seventh grade, it's a long time ago, this was before 9/11, before many people knew who the Taliban were in Afghanistan. I had actually attached to these issues that I was learning about how women were treated under the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, and wrote a speech for my class and talked to them about the challenges of creating a society under a regime like that, where women had not just human rights, but also access to economic opportunity that could lift them out of poverty. And got really into these issues and ended up pursuing that throughout my education. I ended up graduating from the College of William & Mary in Virginia with a degree in government and English, both focused on women's issues. And then, you know, graduated and thought, I really want to develop a career in gender issues and gender studies in the field. And I thought I was going to be, you know, a gender expert in the field, working on USAID-funded or UN-funded projects, for example, working for NGOs and possibly in countries like Rwanda or South Africa. You get the idea. I had these yes. grand plans for myself, right? And I ended up getting a job opportunity for this media company in global development, which was my kind of first step into that industry. And I thought, okay, I'll be here a year or two, and then I'll go do that field work. I'll somehow make my way into that space. And I remember after about a year, I learned so much about the global development industry and really saw that there was an opportunity working for this media company to get a broader purview and influence the industry as a whole so that it could work more for global women's issues in totality rather than doing specific project work on the field. I just learned that those broader trends on working on women's issues were really where my strengths were. And from there, ended up noticing throughout that work that there wasn't a lot going on in fashion and apparel. So I'm getting a little bit little bit off topic here with my mention of women's issues, but a lot of people don't know when you mention this that 80% of garment workers, and there are 12 million of them around the globe, 80% of them are women. And so for me, I saw this opportunity shortly after the Rana Plaza factory collapse in Bangladesh that many people might remember the global headlines of. It killed about 1,000 people, injured about 2,000 more. And I saw, you know, there's got to be a better way here, and sort of realizing how much it impacts women, particularly in countries like Bangladesh, Cambodia, India, and found my way into fashion from there.
Very cool. And just by the way, this is definitely not off topic, because one of the one of the interesting statistics is that actually we talked about this in the previous episode with John King, is that companies that go from, say, more of a top-down structure, they might have a mission statement or talk about good ideas or, you know, good ideals and good values. Every company has their mission statement and their statement of values, right? Every company does, right? But there's a difference between something like what you're doing, where there's, you know, the values actually mean something, even if they aren't. I don't need to have a piece of paper to get an idea of what your mission or your values are at your company.
Right.
Where a lot of companies, it's just symbolic. And when a company goes from it being symbolic to actually being, you know, a group of employees and people connected by a grander vision and connected by a certain resonant values, profits go up by somewhere between 300 to 500% on average within 24 months. So completely relevant. Just saying to the show today, and it's all perfect that it comes up. So,
and I also think, you know, something that I talk a lot about with my fellow co-founder and others in this space is kind of the crazier your goals of social change or environmental change, whatever it is you're working toward, the longer they are, the crazier they are, the more likely you are to make a dent in those issues. And so I think that's also important to note, that it can't just be something that's easily scoped on a piece of paper. It has to be really big and meaty and really almost unreasonable to even think you could achieve it.
Yeah, now, very interesting. So in the realm of, I guess you would call the social entrepreneurship, would that be, would you say, accurate to what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have a master's in social enterprise and spent 3 years studying it. The media company that I worked for identifies as a social enterprise as well. And for me, you know, it doesn't mean that there has to be this dichotomy between nonprofit and for-profit structures in the way that companies operate, but rather there's a blend, right? You can hold profit and purpose with equal value. You can be a very profitable company and very purposeful, making a huge difference in the lives of people. And that to me is kind of the basis of social enterprise and how I would define it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So where did you, you know, for, give us a little bit of sense of your model. So, you know, walk me through how your company actually works.
In terms of how we serve our customers?
Yeah.
Yeah. So a woman would come to our website. She fills out a profile. We walk her through questions like, first of all, what's your sizing? You know, are you tall? Are you petite? Do you typically wear a size 8 pant? The very, very basics of fashion, right? How do you dress yourself? Then we dig into the types of clothes she likes to wear. So does she like stripes or solids or animal print? And dig into a lot more about how she identifies her style, whether that's bohemian, classic, or whether she needs a little help identifying that style of hers. There are a lot of women who come to us who say, I know I want to make an impact with my wardrobe, but I don't actually know how to dress myself. Can you help me with that instead of the other way around? So we then capture a lot of information about what they care about. So we ask questions like, do you care most about human rights, the environment, workers' rights, animal rights? We allow people to multi-select and get into really kind of the impact that they want to make with their purchases. So asking questions about how they can, for example, vote with their dollar if they were to spend money on a particular item. We then take that picture of information that she's given us, go and curate 3 pieces that we have. So we work with a ton of different partners around the globe, everywhere from Cambodia to Ethiopia, to right here in the US, and find pieces of clothing and accessories as well that create that impact that the woman is looking for and also fit her style. put those three items in a box, send them to her door. She gets to open it up, have a beautiful experience. We're really focused on that customer experience and the storytelling aspect that each of those pieces offers. And then we allow her to have a couple days to try on the items, try them out, and send back whatever it is that she doesn't want. And then we take that back into our stock.
Interesting. And then how did you find your supplier, your partners?
Yeah, so that is a great question and something we are always asked by a lot of people in this space, because it's really hard to find products that fit that criteria. And that's actually why Emily and I decided to start. Emily's my co-founder, Emily mm-hmm. Kenny. That's why we decided to start Wearwell, because we kept running into this personal frustration where every time we would go shopping for items like this, we couldn't find something that fit our price point, or we couldn't find something that fit our style, or we had to spend hours searching. And, it was at the time, it was Google searching, or even, Instagram rabbit hole searching, where you just keep going and going and going further to be able to find different brands and different pieces. And you could eventually find something, but it had taken, 8 hours of this type of searching to find.
Right.
So we've been doing that for several years to build up a supplier base and be able to identify the different products that we can source and the different places we can source it from.
Now, there's other companies that do similar things, but mm-hmm. not the social entrepreneurship part. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's companies like Stitch Fix and Trunk Club. Right, and Stitch Fix really pioneered this space and this model. None of them are focused on serving conscious consumers. We're hoping that we offer a nice alternative to people who are looking for conscious closets.
Yeah. Interesting. So when you're starting, or let's say you have an idea, you've identified some social injustice in the world, whatever it may be, right? And you want to start a business around it, or you want to invest in a business around it, either one. How do you ensure that you can never ensure anything 100%, but how do you best ensure that you're going to make it, right? Like what would stop someone else from doing, the exact same thing that you're doing? Because obviously making a profit will be tied to making a difference here. So how do you actually prevent yourself from, the profit getting eaten away by other people seeing what you're doing and just coming to the space and literally doing the exact same thing?
Yeah, I think you run that risk with any startup business, right? Like how do you get your idea out there enough where you can generate the tribe around you that's willing to support you and help you, but not generate enough interest that somebody just rips you off and replicates
it? Yeah.
It's the same exact thing in the social impact space, but with one big caveat, and that is if you're creating a model that is replicable, that's actually a really great thing because together you're going to make a much bigger difference. And, we wouldn't be in this just to make a profit. We are really in this to try to change an industry. Right. And if another business starts up and is also successful, getting competitors can really be some of the best things that ever happened to you. So that would be a great thing in a certain way, right? It make us both work harder.
And you grow the industry more.
And we grow the industry, right? Exactly. So I think, I think there's a good place to kind of begin looking at this, and that's the social enterprise models that have cropped up locally in different cities to serve populations. So I'm thinking about, DC Central Kitchen is a very well-known one that has recently, in the past few years, scaled to LA. And there's another small organization I know of in New Orleans working on housing issues. And the more that they're able to prove their concept with their model, the more that they want to encourage other cities to replicate it, because then they are helping the entire space improve and rise from a geographic model. And we kind of look at that, but sub-industry for geography.
Interesting. Do you watch Elon Musk interviews by any chance?
I don't know.
Okay, because that's like an answer that Elon Musk would have given, except for
really?
for cars instead of fashion. If people ask him, well, what stops people, you don't have a lot of patents, what stops people from doing, building similar kinds of cars and replicating what you do? He's like, I hope more people do what we do, because we're trying to change an industry here. Like it's the same, same mentality, and it ends up statistically, not anecdotally any one company, but ends up making more money too, that kind of mindset. Interesting. So if you are in, okay, here's an interesting question. So from an investment standpoint, let's say you're not coming from, being a CEO right now, but you were coming in from, I'm going to invest in a company that's doing social entrepreneurship. What kinds of things would you be looking for, and what kinds of things would you see as red flags?
So I'll start with the red flag, because it leads to what I'm looking for, right? Okay. So I want to know that somebody's really serious about their impact. And, you know, one thing that I always think about and I have to communicate to people is the idea of kind of what Emily and I term a give back feature, or charitable giving. Some people call it one for one, where, you know, if you're talking about the clothing industry in particular, if somebody is making an item and their plan for social impact is to give away an item, how are you making a positive impact? You might be, you know, giving somebody a piece of clothing that they might not have otherwise, right? Mm-hmm. But you might also be collapsing a local industry in that community, or you might be contributing to waste on a larger scale. And instead, if you focused on the manufacturing and the production of that product, you might be creating a much better impact. And you know, that's not always true. There are always different circumstances, and that's what leads to what I look for. I look for somebody who really knows the nuances of their space. They've thought about all of the ramifications. They've thought about the trade-offs, because there's always trade-offs in the social impact space. You can never build a perfect model. So you know, looking at, okay, how do I maximize the impact here? And really kind of falling in love with the problem. That's a term that one of my...
I love that.
Yeah, it's a term that one of my professors used that always stuck with me. You have to fall in love with the problem. And I think, you know, as someone who has always, my entire life, I've gotten really frustrated with the problems. Like, they make me angry, and I get really annoyed that people haven't found more solutions. And I've always been a little bit more of a doer, right? And so I'll see a problem and go, all right, what can we do about this? But you have to fall in love with the problem and be committed to it and know it in and out, so that you can find the right solutions and the right paths forward. And so if they haven't fallen in love with the problem yet, if they're just taking the opportunity to do what they think might make a little bit of difference, or what they think is enough difference, they're not there yet.
Interesting. Now, historically, do most companies that are in the social entrepreneurship space, do they tend to continue to operate as standalone companies, or does it usually make more sense to be sold to a larger company and then have, you know, more access to resources and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I would tell people, take a look at Honesty and what their journey has looked like. I think it really depends on the social enterprise. You know, you've got some social enterprises that are started as for-profit arms of nonprofits, and it's a great way to fuel the nonprofit's community work or social impact side. You've got other social enterprises that are incorporated as nonprofits, so no, they can't be purchased. Right. But you've got ones like Honesty, for example, where they've been purchased by a very large entity, and the founders have done a relatively good job of keeping control over the mission while grabbing on to the resources of a larger entity that can allow them to scale, can get their distribution increased. And I think it really depends on the industry and what you're looking at. But I do think it's a chronic issue in the social enterprise space that it's always under-resourced. So, you know, it's harder to find investors that are willing to look at how do you balance profit and purpose. Very, very difficult if you're not focused on profit at all.
Of course,
you're not gonna
yeah.
succeed either, right? But
I'm glad you get that, because I can't tell you how many people in the nonprofit space that they're very ideological, you know, idealistic. It's great, but it's like you're not dealing with reality.
Exactly. You have to have a sustainable business model, right? But finding investors that are looking at both, you know, there's been the emergence of impact investing, which is great, but there's still kind of this vacancy of impact angel investors in the space that can really allow companies to grow. And so if companies start to be able to grow and they can latch on to the growth potential that a really large company offers them, I think it can be a great model to start to scale and again, shift whole industries.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then with the internet and you know, crowdfunding and all these technologies now, I only see that getting bigger.
Yeah, exactly. And if they can start to grow the bottom line within that company and prove their worth even more, and they can start to take over a percentage of that company's bottom line that was more than they ever imagined, it proves to the whole company that it's worth shifting their practices in certain ways.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you guys do anything where, have you ever worked with any suppliers that maybe didn't have the best practices, but they wanted to work with you, so they changed their practices? Has that happened yet or no?
That has not happened yet, but this is something that we've given a lot of thought to. You know, I think there was an incident, I want to say it was about 2 years ago now, where there was a supplier that worked with both Stella McCartney and Patagonia, both very well respected in the ethical fashion space in particular. And the supplier was known to be treating their sheep very harmfully, the sheep that they harvested the wool from. And Stella McCartney came out with this, her brand came out with a statement saying, we're no longer going to be working with them. We're done with this supplier. We're committed to our ethics and no more from them. Mm-hmm. And Patagonia came out with another statement saying, this is truly unacceptable to us, but we're going to work with them. Because if we stop working with them, they're just going to find another company that may not care either way.
I like that mindset so much better.
Exactly, exactly. And that is right where Emily and I are. We know it's important to work, you know, within reason, of course, sure, but to work with companies to bring them up to the place where they need to be in order to meet our criteria. But we also, it's really, if I can really nerd out for a second here, we built a whole scale for ourselves that, you know, we really dig into three different areas where a company that is producing clothing can make a positive impact. And the very first one you can imagine is in workers' rights. Are they paying their makers a fair wage, a living wage? Just, you know, what makes sense for the country that they're located in? Do they work normal hours? You get the idea. A bunch of indicators in that bucket, a bunch of indicators in the sustainability bucket. And then a third area, which is that charitable give back feature that we just record for our own purposes as well to see the trends in the space. And we rate our partners on all of those indicators. And our goal is over time, we're not quite there yet, but our goal over time is to create a standard score that they all have to meet and start to increase that score over time so that they all have to improve.
That's so cool. Whole Foods does something similar. They do.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. And then they use, there's a company called Where Foods Come From, which they use to help create certain standards and different foods to make sure they're humane and all that. Interesting.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that comes up for Whole Foods as well as other companies like that and in the space that we're in is the need for more transparency. And I think what you'll see is that, you know, a group like Whole Foods, they're working on making it easier for consumers to shop a certain way. I'm not comparing ourselves to Whole Foods, but we have a similar goal in mind, right? And they need to partner with groups that can look at the transparency side of things. Like recently learned of a group called Labor Voices that is in San Francisco that's doing really cool stuff, making it easier for garment workers inside factories to just send SMS text messages and testimonials about what the factory is like on the inside, and then tracing that supply chain, which is giving brands better access to that information. So I think we're starting to see this convergence of consumer access and access to traceability and data.
I love that model. I think there is such a market demand for, especially more than ever today, with transparency and knowing, you know, knowing where your products come from, knowing where your food comes from, and all of these things. And it hasn't been sufficient to, you know, have a bunch of government bureaucrats, you know, who are going to be influenced politically versus having, you know, market forces where the politics, it's going to be less politically influenced and it's going to be, you know, there's a profit incentive for these companies to actually give good information.
Right, exactly. You
know, it's like if people trust Consumer Reports, people don't really trust the FDA. No offense to anyone who works for the FDA, but like you don't trust it because it's going to be politically influenced. The five-star rating for car companies is the same thing. That's not a government institution, and people when a car gets a five-star rating, it means something.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. You have any heroes in the space, like people that you'd look up to, lessons you've learned from them?
Oh yeah, there are many. There's a where do I begin? Eileen Fisher, I think, is one. She started a major clothing brand that has had sustainability baked into it from day one. The founding team and the woman who started PeopleTree is definitely her name. Why is her name escaping me right now? I'm looking it up while we're chatting. Sophia Mini. Sophia Mini really has pioneered this space, particularly with her brand People Tree, which is in the UK.
Yeah.
And really kind of showing that you can create beautifully made products that pay the makers a living wage, that use non-toxic dyes, that are reasonable price points that people can afford. And she took that risk of saying, you know, I think this can be done. I'm going to try it. And then I also have to say, you know, I look to bigger brands as well that are starting to make waves in this space. I kind of look to them as heroes because they're putting resources behind this. So, for example, Kate Spade has a line called On Purpose, where they worked with several years ago, they worked with a women's cooperative in Rwanda, helped them incorporate as a legal social enterprise in Rwanda. It's a legal entity there the way that it is not here in the U.S., and worked with them to build a facility that was safe, that had the right resources for them. And now Kate Spade sources embroidery from the former women's cooperative that's now employee-owned by these women in Rwanda, and gives them steady business and steady income. And it's something that they've just integrated into their work and into their lines in a way that takes a lot of guts, a lot of risk for a company to put money behind. So I'd also highlight companies like that that are looking at this as a true investment in their future.
So if an individual or an investment group wanted to put money behind something like this, where do you find these kinds of opportunities to make a difference through funding, startup companies like this?
Yeah, so selfishly, I'd say focus on the ones focus on the ones that are looking at broader scale industry change. There are a lot of little shops out there that are doing great things. They also need help, right? But you can only scale your impact with so many scarves sold or so many bags sold, right? You have to look at how do you change consumer mindsets. How do you change the industry as a whole? So I would encourage people to look there. There's also a lot of activity happening right now in the circular economy. So how do you look at not just the impact through manufacturing, but the impact through the whole life cycle of a product? So where does that t-shirt go? Does it go into a landfill, or can it be recycled? Can it be reused in some manner? And can you standardize that across the industry? So there's a lot of activity there that I think is going to make a huge impact in the long run.
And then on the flip side, for someone who's has an idea for a startup or running a small company and wants more capital, what are some pieces of advice in terms of finding potential investors who will kind of get this? Because I think some people might just not get it.
Yeah, it's a big challenge and something that we are still facing, right? So I'd say, plug yourself into communities in large cities that have a space like this. So I've spent a lot of time over the past year bouncing around to major cities and secondary cities. And when I've gone to the secondary cities or even the tertiary and said social enterprise, I get this kind of very confused look. Mm-hmm. People go, wait, so like social media? And you have to explain.
Right.
No, talking about social impact, talking about profit and purpose together. But in communities like New York and communities like San Francisco, it's worth spending time there and getting to know people and searching for people who care about things, but also care about sustainable business models. And I think that's hard to find in areas where that hasn't picked up as much.
I would imagine Boston's probably pretty good at that too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I've not spent a lot of time in Boston, but I can imagine it would be, yeah.
Because there's a big tech community, and I feel like tech and this often goes hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Any book recommendations you would have for people who want to learn more about the space, either just for knowledge or to start a business or, invest in the space? Any good books?
Yeah, I have a movie, actually. It's on Netflix. It's called The True And
it's called The Water. Broke up a little bit there.
That's okay. It's called The True Cost. And it features Sophia Mini, actually, so you can meet one of the heroes I noted. But it is the best overview I have found so far of what the conscious fashion space could be and what the problems are behind it. It doesn't look as much toward solutions. So I would encourage people to read a little bit more if they can in the popular press about what that might be. Look into companies like Niccolo, look at the evolution of the TOMS model, the one-for-one model, and other ones that I always call TOMS like the gateway, right? Making people think about their purchases. So start looking at companies that have come out of that movement to really get a sense of the timeline and the trajectory and get a sense of what's next. Yeah, I got so many recommendations. I feel like I should send you some that you can put in the show notes.
Yeah, why don't you send me an email and then I will put that in the notes.
That's perfect.
Sweet. Before we wrap it up, I don't know, is there anything else that you'd want to share or want to say or, you know, to our listeners or?
No, I mean, I think it goes without saying that this space is kind of, this is where I personally see every industry headed. I think we're at a turning point where people want to know that they're making an impact with their dollars. And so there's no longer going to be a question if you fast forward 20 years from now of, you know, can I spend my money this way? Will it make an impact? That won't be a novel thing anymore. So I would just say, you know, parting thoughts.
a quick question. Ten years from now, predictions. What do you see are some of the major changes going on that, you know, it'll be totally different within 10 years. Just what are your predictions? We'll come back in 10 years from now and see how well you did. That's part two.
So I think customers are totally looking for interesting new experiences, right? So everybody keeps saying retail is dead. I don't think retail is dead. I think if you give people an experience that they are actually looking for in a retail setting, they will come, right? So I'm not going to say 10 years from now there will be no more malls, there will be no more storefronts. I think we're going to see people shopping in a way where they're searching for experience, they're searching for connections to the items that they purchase, whether that is clothing or consumer goods. They see a reason and an impact for their purchase. And I am started, like, I think that fast fashion will go away. That's a hope, maybe more than a prediction.
When you say fast fashion, do you mean like trends changing every like 3 months or something? Is that what you mean by that? Or?
Yeah, so fast fashion is a specific segment of the fashion industry. So, you know, companies like H&M and Zara, Forever 21, companies that produce at a very, very large scale, and their price points are very, very low. They often are turning product around so quickly to customers that the customer mentality starts to begin to look at those products as disposable, something that they might just be able to cast away. And so the price point is therefore driven even lower by customer demand. And the companies themselves look at how they can get new product on the floor every single week or two. So there used to be 6 seasons in the fashion industry. There's now 52 seasons in the fashion industry. So it gives you a sense of how...
Wow.
That is, yeah. And I think we're on the cusp of that starting to backfire a little bit. And, you know, I don't wish that H&M and Zara would completely go out of business. I hope that they start to change their model. And H&M has started to make strides with their conscious collection and doing a lot of other things to explore how they might shift. So I think fast fashion as we know it today will start.
So maybe you're saying that the model for Forever 21 just may not be forever.
Right. I think it's going to be necessary for them to change the way that they
I've been waiting to say that line for the last like 5 minutes and I have.
Great.
Right. I felt so witty saying that too.
Very nice.
Thank you. Right on. Well, cool. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. And for people who want to check out what you do, what's your website?
Yeah, they can go to shopwearwell.com. It's shopwearwell.com.
Okay, and then are you, if you don't want to talk about this is fine, but are you currently taking investment?
We are,
If people want to find out more in terms of, you know, potentially investing in your company, what would be the best way to get in touch?
Yeah, send me an email. We're raising a seed round right now. My email is Erin, E-R-I-N, @shopwearwell.com, and happy to share more details and chat.
Awesome. And for total legal purposes, this is not an offer or solicitation for any kind of securities or anything like that or any kind of recommendation of what to do, and go to an investment advisor for that. Okay, cool. just get that out of the
Thank
way.
Thank you, Eric. Understood.
Yes. All right, right on. Well, thank you again for your time, and have an amazing rest of your day.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.